dare you? How dare you put your hands on me, you filth?
Wanted for 30 counts of smuggling.
20 counts of homicide. Transportation of stolen goods. James! And you slept with my sister.
Oh.
I'm a bad, bad man.
Maybe I have been falsely accused once or twice.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions in the brave new world of 2019. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, sipping jippers on a beach somewhere.
And we're here this week to talk about the final short trek in the first season of Short Trek's Escape Artist.
Actually, Cam, I want to rescind that. I'm actually penetrating a space whale.
Oh.
You had to be there.
I had to be there. So yes, we're going to wrap up the first season of Short Treks tonight and talk about the Harry Mudd-rific final installment that was directed by Rainn Wilson. And then I think we're going to talk about these Short Treks. Were they worth our time? I mean, the hour it took to watch them all?
Yeah. Cumulatively, about 60 minutes.
And do we want to see more of them going forward? Were they artistically satisfying? So I think that'll be interesting to delve into once we kind of wrap up our discussion of The Escape Artist.
Yeah. So Cam, notably, you pointed out the fact that Rainn Wilson directed this one. I also want to point out the fact that Mike McMahon wrote this one.
Right. And who is that, Tyler?
He's going to be the one who is creating Star Trek Lower Decks, the new Star Trek animated series that I think you and I, we discussed it before. We're actually looking forward to this one quite a bit because I think there's the opportunity for them to play around with a lot of Star Trek tropes and make it a very interesting kind of subversive version of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Does your viewing of The Escape Artist kind of give you hope for Star Trek Lower Decks moving forward?
It does, in the sense you can tell that Mike McMahon really loves Star Trek canon.
And I think the fact that he displays right here, he can be very subversive towards Star Trek, but very much honoring Star Trek as well.
Yeah.
Everything about this episode made me smile.
This was a tribute to an episode of the original series I never thought I would see a tribute to.
What? Mudd's Women?
No, I, Mudd.
Mudd's Women was the first introduction of Harry Mudd, and I, Mudd was the one with all the androids.
Right.
Because we had that great, I'll say this, I thought it was a great reveal / twist that we had at the end where the Mudd that we've been following for what we figured was the majority of this entire adventure was in fact an android, Cam.
Yes.
I have to say this, Cam, let's flash back about 18 months ago, and all you heard from Tyler was, I think Harry Mudd in this Star Trek universe is the worst idea ever. And every single time he's been on the series, I'm like, Harry Mudd, best idea ever. And this just reemphasizes this to me. I think this was, okay, I think Calypso was just on this huge peak, right, for me. But I think The Escape Artist may have eclipsed Calypso as well, when it comes to these Short Treks, at least.
Right, yeah.
What was your initial feeling with regards to The Escape Artist, Cam?
I mean, I had an absolute blast of this episode.
Yeah.
Right off the bat, with the credits that are kind of crazy.
The disco sort of...
It feels very Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
I mean, okay. I think that's pretty an intentional rip there.
But okay, from the music to just the actual kind of fonts and just kind of, you know, jibe they're given towards kind of Star Trek sort of stuff. This felt very 70s, didn't it?
It did feel very 70s. And it definitely had a retro feel, which I think is a really good idea with a character like Harry Mudd, who dresses like an old sea shanty captain or something half the time.
I mean, that's how I dress. I don't know what you're talking about.
Is that why there's a parrot on your shoulder?
And a peg leg on my leg.
Where else would it be?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Actually, you know what? If I was an android Harry Mudd, they'd just pull it right off my body. You know, bam.
But what I really liked about this episode is, we've talked a lot about Harry Mudd in Discovery and how it does feel like a very different character than the original series.
Yes.
You know, his two appearances were like these very, very goofball, out there, weirdo episodes. Like they were not in the, like not taking themselves seriously in the slightest. Whereas we see Harry Mudd in Discovery, like even if the episode's a little goofy, like Magic That Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, they take this character very seriously and treat him as someone who's incredibly dangerous, which the original series did not. But I feel like this episode, even though we never see the main Harry Mudd on screen for the majority of the episode, I feel like this distilled the essence of Harry Mudd right down to what this character is.
I think so. Look, I had huge problems with the TOS version of Harry Mudd.
Yeah.
He's introduced as a sex trafficker, and we're all supposed to kind of like smile and go, aw shucks, to a literal sex trafficker.
Yeah.
And then they kind of... The
behind-the-scenes notes on that episode are amazing, and I recommend anyone just, you know, pop over to Memory Alpha, which has a good bank of interview quotes at the time of people talking about the development of that episode.
I can only imagine me being horrified.
It's pretty amusing.
Okay, okay. We go back to Mudd's... Or no, I, Mudd. I keep getting those two confused, but like...
Right, you're not the only one.
Yeah. But, and like... It's the android illusion that we get here, but like, it is not a good episode.
No.
It's kind of hard to just watch. It's really dumb. Although I do say the dance sequence that we get from our main crew is one of the most amazing things ever.
Yeah.
So I don't know. And then maybe let's talk about the animated series. He has an appearance in that as well.
Yeah, Mudd's Passion.
It's actually, I think it's actually an okay appearance.
I actually enjoy that one, I think, the most of the three kind of vintage Mudd appearances.
Yeah, I would say so too.
It's funny, like, Mudd's Women is not a good episode at all. And I'm Mudd, like, it's definitely swinging for the fences in weirdness. But I think if it comes down to it, and you ask me which one is the more, like, the story that seems more well thought out, I feel like... Mudd's Women is, even though I don't really like what that episode is doing, I feel like it's just a more thought out. I mean, look, they had a lot of time to come up with that idea. That's right before the show even starts. Roddenberry's coming up with the idea for that episode, but it does feel like an episode that he really thought through his beginning, middle, and end. Whereas I feel like I, Mudd is just like them throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks. Like it little bits might work for you, but I find it just kind of scattershot.
Well, I'll give it to, you know, that episode to the degree that I think TOS went to the android well quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that idea. I kind of like the idea of with them playing with the androids, whether it's iMud or What Are Little Girls Made Of. What is a great one where we have the entities that occupy the bodies of Spock, Kirk, and Diane Mulder.
Oh, Return to Tomorrow.
Return to Tomorrow. And then they want to occupy, like, android bodies later on.
Very unappealing ones.
Disgusting-looking android bodies that are slimy and, anyways.
There's also the episode Requiem from Methuselah in Season 3. Like, they really go back to that well a lot.
And I think, and Cam, you've heard me before on the podcast talk about how, you know what Discovery needs? More androids.
Right.
We haven't had enough androids. And I love the fact that, before the big reveal that this Mudd that we've been following for pretty much the entire episode was in fact an android, we actually had Daft Punk from the Shenzhou.
Yeah.
I think it was the same. It was meant to be the same Daft Punk,
or was it just someone wearing the same technology
helmet? Because I think it was established that Daft Punk was in fact a human, just wearing like a specialized helmet.
Yeah,
I'd like to think that Daft Punk from the Shenzhou is here on the USS DeMilo.
Yeah.
Anyways. They're
on the mission to Venus.
I think you can. That's,
you're welcome.
I think
one's free, folks. Happy New Year.
I think I know what you're setting yourself up for a little bit, maybe at the very end of the episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but anyways, spoiler, I apologize. But I do like...
You say spoiler, but you already gave away the ending of the episode right off the top.
I apologize. No, but you know what? I'd like to think so. Maybe they're kind of hinting at it with that little tiny Daft Punk sort of... like cameo that we got, and then we are introduced to a million different android Mudds.
Yeah,
and one of which was wearing like his very iconic sort of nautical outfit.
I was gonna mention that. I loved it though. Yeah,
can you not tell that this episode is written by somebody who absolutely adores Star Trek?
Oh yeah, big time. And you know, the androids of I, Mudd feel, I think my take on that whole episode when I saw it, you know, a couple years ago, it's not an episode I revisit much, but was that it was just kind of a lark episode. Like, hey, what if Harry Mudd had androids? Okay, moving on. You know, we're not going to see this character again in the series, but when he shows up in the animated series, it's love potions. You know, it's a different thing every time.
Yeah.
I like the idea that they're working this androids into the canon of the character, where like this is something he would utilize for his schemes. Like, it makes total sense.
Well, they're pulling from the mythology that we are aware of, and they're actually kind of building up the mythology that's, you know, chronologically will, you know, that will be revealed to anybody who decides to watch Star Trek Discovery for the very first time.
There is a child right now watching Star Trek Discovery. Discovery who one day will seg into the TOS universe.
That would be something.
He'll be very confused by these Harry Mudd episodes.
They'll be very confused by the retrograde technology all of the characters suddenly start adopting about 10 years down the road.
Yeah.
That said, so Cam, okay, you and I, we had a great discussion a couple weeks ago when we were doing our season one overview of Star Trek Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we kind of both agreed on is that Discovery seems to work best when it is not taking itself so seriously.
Right.
But it's really like the lighter moments. This is like 15 minutes of nonstop sort of like lighter moments.
Right.
How do you think this one worked as a fully kind of realized short Trek episode?
I think it worked incredibly well. Like, it had a really fun premise. I think it's something that really hammers home who this character of Harry Mudd is that he's a con man who's always kind of giving the same bluster. Like, that's something I think that became very apparent on the original series. This character is all bluster and just kind of weaselly. And it's how much he can talk his way out of trouble. But we see throughout this episode, you know, this 15 minutes really distills down what Harry Mudd is. He's this character who's always going to try and use the same lines over and over and over just to see what works. But he always has like another track he can switch to, but he just repeats himself over and over again, which makes perfect sense when you're using androids.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think it makes total sense with the representation of the character here. Like, this feels, you know, I said right off the bat, like, this feels like one of the best distillations of Harry Mudd I've ever seen.
I just wonder if this is kind of the tone that I wish Star Trek Discovery had hit from the outset here. Because I think this is a tone that works.
Yeah.
And I'll pitch
Are you
this
implying
to you.
The Vulcan hello wasn't that tone?
No, but you know, I genuinely think that the Vulcan hello and Battle of the Binary Stars,
mm-hmm.
probably the best pilot, if you want to consider them as like a single entity, probably the best pilot that we've ever had for a Star Trek series.
I thought Tom Paris was the best pilot.
Well, you know, if you ask Jellicoe, he had to find out that it was in fact Riker.
Right,
he had
right.
to go get on his knees and beg Riker to go on this mission after he dismissed him as first officer.
Right.
I'm sure there's many more a pilot joke we can make with regards to Star Trek. But, you know, I thought that was a great start for Star Trek. But then they kind of fell into this trap of, like, taking themselves very seriously.
Right.
Where we actually found watching the show, like, it was their lighter moments that worked best.
Mm-hmm.
And so we watch like an episode like this, and I'm just like, this is just kind of the right tone in which there's this reverence for Star Trek. It's funny without like ridiculing what makes Star Trek great.
Right.
I don't know if this would work for Star Trek Discovery week to week, but
sure.
Let me ask you this, Cam. Maybe there
every
have
been... week is like just like this.
Well,
it's Harry Mudd and his androids.
I'll say this: there have been maybe rumors of a Harry Mudd spinoff, which.
Yeah.
I rolled my eyes at, but a mere an hour ago.
Yeah.
after watching this, do you think that a Harry Mudd spinoff could work, you know, for a full 45 minutes for 13 consecutive weeks?
What about a sitcom level? Like, what about 20 minutes?
20 minutes of that? I think
that has a better shot.
Anything's on the table right
now. Yeah.
We're getting Short Treks. We're getting a Picard spinoff. We're getting an animated series. I think anything's on the table right now. What do you think would be the best format for a potential Harry Mudd spinoff that takes place within, you know, contemporaneously with Star Trek Discovery?
I think the problem with Harry Mudd, though, is that Harry Mudd as a character doesn't really... It's kind of like making Jack Sparrow your lead, which is something the Pirates movies made the huge fatal mistake of. Is that you had Keira Knightley and Orlando Bloom really anchoring Jamaica. I know. As soon as I was saying it, I was like, oh boy, here with the nautical puns. But no, like, they really anchored those first, you know, Pirates movies. And boy, Pirates 3 is a mess. But they're still kind of holding it down. But then, like, when you get to the part 4 and 5 and Jack Sparrow's the star, the movies are completely off the rails. I think you need, you know, a character who is, quote-unquote, a little boring. Like, someone
like
who's, like, your
straight man.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think... You need that with Harry Mudd. I think if you just had Harry Mudd doing wacky things every week, that would get old quick. But I do think if you're going to do it, like a 22-minute format works best. I mean, obviously, if it's, you know, Netflix or streaming, it doesn't have to be 22 minutes. But just like a sitcom-length format where you could just have fun little adventures that could be very fast-paced. I think the reason this short track works so well is because it's very fast-paced. It's 15 minutes. It's in and out. You know, and nowadays, sitcoms on, say, broadcast TV are like 21 minutes, I think, and then you take away credits, it's like 20 minutes. I think that's the perfect format for Harry Mudd. I think if you were to do a 45-minute Harry Mudd story every week, that could be pretty bad.
Are we living like Dwight Schrute's fantasy right now, in which he gets to embody a Star Trek character and act it out over the course of a week?
Yeah, we pretty much are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Look, I think actually you're on the right track here. I like how Trek. You need. but I think you
it's
know,
a short
like,
track, Tyler.
I'm sorry. I don't even know what I'm doing right now. Yeah. No, but I think, look, stretching out to 45 minutes, Harry Mudd might become grating. And that was my big concern about, you know, watching this guy. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you're right. You know, let's do 22, 25 minutes. I mean, look, it's CBS All Access. It can go forever long that the story dictates. But I think if you keep this fast pace going, mm-hmm. you've got a great character who is like, he's got some great lines. Let's talk about like the regicide accusation that he got there. And like Harry Mudd clarifies, it was a duke. Right. What are you trying to murder now? Accuracy?
Yeah.
I mean, that's legit funny.
Well, they played with language a lot in this story, and I enjoyed that a lot. Like, Star Trek, I don't know that it's known for its nimble dialogue, especially when Geordi LaForge is talking. But, I mean, I feel like they were really going for that here. And if you listen to the dialogue in the original Harry Mudd TOS episodes, it's very flowery. Like, they were really writing Harry Mudd to really stand out from all the other characters. And I like that they were really hammering that down here too. Like they were really focused on that. And yeah, you get to have really fun lines where he's just instantly bouncing back at any character who puts him down or ridicules him. The whole, you know, ongoing bit about the cudgel, you know, not knowing what a cudgel is. And the funny thing is, I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, what exactly is a cudgel?
So actually, I only realized what a cudgel was. I think I had been like reading, you know, the Song of Ice and Fire series recently.
Right.
And there's a reference made to a cudgel in that. And okay. So I had to like look it up in a dictionary. And so I did know what a cudgel was the
right.
entire time.
Yeah.
What Harry Mudd, the legit Harry Mudd, is holding at the end, I don't think that's like exactly a 9th century version of a cudgel that we're so familiar with.
Okay.
Think of it as just like a way to beat someone in the head with like a very hard object.
Right,
but,
right.
But yeah, pretty much like, I'm sorry, I digress.
Much
cuddle
chat.
This
is very helpful.
Yeah. No, but it's essentially like a beating tool aimed at somebody's head.
Okay.
That it's kind of held like a stick. Like
right.
They got the shape right, but like this cudgel had like this big like scepter on it.
Right.
I guess, you know, that was a big reason why that the Tellarite bounty hunter, and I love the fact that they're establishing the Tellarites as bounty hunters once again after our experience in Star Trek Enterprise with Archer.
In the episode Bounty.
Was that not like a great kind of like callback to
it is, yeah.
you know, Star Trek history? I just love the fact that Mike McMahon seems to be the perfect person to do like a Star Trek comedy series with Lower Decks. Like this, you and I were totally on board with this idea when it was first announced. I think you and I even may have said that we're more excited about this than maybe the Picard spinoff.
Right.
And the fact that we get to see him like working in this universe, I am just so excited now to see what he's going to bring to the table with Star Trek Lower Decks.
Well, you look at what he did in 15 minutes. You know, he's throwing in Klingons and Tellarites and Orions. And the Orion part I really loved, where you had Harry Mudd trying to dupe this Orion dude who's not the brightest, this guard, with riches and what have you. And then the female Orion comes in and is like, you realize we have a camera.
That's just it. Like, they're being subversive.
Yeah.
They're playing with the tropes that we're so used to with these kinds of stories. And, like, every time I watch this sort of stuff where, like, you know, the guy who's trapped is trying to talk his guard out of it.
Yeah.
I'm like, aren't they surveilling everything that's going on?
Right.
You know, like, I love this sort of storytelling here. And, Cam, I have to say, your face is looking a quite delectable lime right now as well. So.
It's post-New Year's.
You're still recovery mode.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
No, I just loved how we got to see these various aliens. And there was another alien bounty hunter. Did you recognize that species?
I was going,
diminutive one.
I was going back and forth. I was like, is that supposed to be like a tiny Klingon? Because it looked kind of Klingon-ish.
Or it looked kind of like a tiny Reman.
Like a
redesigned Reman.
I looked at the ears, and they don't have the distinct Reman ear. So it's definitely not a Reman. It's not a Klingon.
Yeah.
I did not recognize the species. And we looked at the end credits. She is labeled as bounty hunter.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe we'll learn more about this species later on. I don't know why they didn't
I'm just wondering if it's one that popped up in like one shot of an episode somewhere in Discovery.
But then like, what's the point of that? Or like, why not go back to like a more familiar alien, give them a bit of a redesign and be like, oh, like that's a great call. This is a brand new alien. I was just kind of like, I don't know. I just kind of shrugged my shoulders at who this was. I wasn't nearly as invested as I think that I should have been.
Not like you were with Poe.
Cam, I guarantee you.
As we get further and further away from Runaway.
We are going to get a Poe return at some point in season 2 of Discovery.
Right.
It's going to happen, and I'm not looking forward to it. Anyway. Yeah. I don't know. Just any final thoughts on Star Trek The Escape Artist before we kind of like tackle, I guess, Short Treks as a whole?
Do you think we'll see this type of tone brought into Discovery as we go into season 2?
Okay, so I think they must realize, at least based on the marketing that we've seen for Star Trek Discovery season 2, that maybe Discovery works best when it's being a little bit lighter and not taking itself so seriously. I see more scenes with this tone, but an entire episode like we've got right now, and mind you, it's about 15 minutes. I don't know. I think that's kind of a tough thing to call for, because Discovery has already kind of set its tone in season one. So I would say we'll get, I think we're counting on more lighter moments throughout Star Trek Discovery season 2. And I honestly think it's the best. I think that's when Star Trek Discovery is at its best, though. And by light, it doesn't have to be like goofy, let's like make fart jokes sort of stuff. Or as we saw in the marketing, sneeze jokes in the Turbo Lift, which that's not what I'm really talking about when I'm saying Star Trek Discovery is at its best when it's being, you know, lighter. I hope Discovery is lighter. I think this shows that you can work within this Discovery established universe and be lighter and actually just make the fans, or at least two fans sitting right here who literally just watched the episode and started talking about it, go wild. You know, I mean, I had to calm you down.
I was like leaping on the couch.
I know. I had to like give you like a bit of a sippy cup and, you know, like settle you down before we started recording. But I like, what are you hoping for? Is this, maybe we can use this to segue into our discussion about overall, you know, Star Trek Short Treks. But I mean, what are you hoping for Discovery season 2 with what this might portend to?
I'm hoping that we may get another fun Harry Mudd episode. Like, when we watched Choose Your Pain way back, you know, in 2017, I remember watching that episode and really enjoying it and liking what Rainn Wilson was doing with Harry Mudd, but also having a lot of trouble lining it up in my head with what Roger Carmel had done in the original series. Mm-hmm. Like, I liked the updated take on Harry Mudd, but it didn't fit canon-wise with my memories of that character. Whereas when we got to Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, they began to align a little better. I was like, okay, this definitely lines up more with the idea of who Harry Mudd is. I think he's a little more homicidal in the Discovery universe than he was in the original series. Like, they said he had something like 20 counts of attempted homicide in this short. And I'm like, I don't remember him being that deadly in the original series. But either way, I don't care. But
you don't care.
But
you already knew he was a sociopath.
Yeah, of course.
The sex trafficking and all that. So, okay.
But, but I'm hoping, though, that with Magic and then this, we're going to see episodes of Discovery that kind of have this kind of tone with Harry Mudd. Like, they have, like, you know, I've said in the past, like, I hope Discovery had, like, their Q-type episodes where you could bring in an antagonist character who could really do something really interesting in the way that Q did. Like, Q, you could use him in kind of goofy episodes, but you can use him in some really serious ones that brought a lot out of the characters. And Discovery doesn't have that character yet. And I had thought at the time, you know, when I maybe a few months ago, like, I thought maybe Georgiou was going to become that, but I'm getting the sense that's not the case and that they are tying her into the mythology of the ongoing story of Discovery.
I agree with you.
So I'm hoping that maybe Harry Mudd can fulfill that purpose and that we get these episodes that do kind of stand alone, and they can be maybe a little more serious like Choose Your Pain or really goofy like this, but allow them to do a lot with Rainn Wilson, who's just such a talented actor. Like, if you've got him ready and willing to be on your Star Trek series, why would you not want to use him?
So, Cam, Rainn Wilson is literally directing the Short Treks now.
He's directing 15-minute streaming episodes
for them. He wants to be in on this. And I think, like, honestly, the fact that he's doing this, I mean, like, I'm going to go out there. I say that this is going to be embraced by mainstream Star Trek audiences. I really think that this is a very successful short trek here.
Yeah.
I think if this is going to be used as a litmus test for CBS to maybe pursue additional Harry Mudd moments, and Rainn Wilson seems to be very invested in this, I mean, I think this is looking up for the character, a character who I did not want to see 18 months ago, who I was like, Cam, you literally saw me just like tearing out like my beard hair like over all of this.
Isn't there something kind of exciting though about like taking a very damaged character and like bringing them to life? Like, they didn't work initially, really.
Well, it's kind of like when I brought you onto this podcast.
Exactly. I was broken. You and Ben Yong breathed life into me. Look at me now.
Okay, so New Year's Eve, Ben Yong came over. You guys chatted a little bit. How was reminiscing about some of our Star Trek experiences? How did that go for you?
Well, I have an update for, you know, Ben Yong's been watching Star Trek Discovery.
See, I didn't even know that.
Okay. He's just finished The Butcher's Knife.
Okay.
From, you know, episode 4 of Discovery, and he's not quite on board yet.
Okay.
So I'll get back to you when I know more.
Do you think he will catch up in time to get him onto a podcast episode for season 2? Maybe the finale?
Of the series, maybe.
I like how maybe of all our new listeners, like Ben Yong is but merely kind of a myth at this point.
No, but he is for us as well.
Yeah, that's true.
The man, the myth, the legend.
What do you think about Rainn Wilson's interest with regards to, you know, pursuing Harry Mudd as a character?
I'm intrigued by it because, you know, I get the sense like Rainn Wilson really loves Star Trek. Like, when you hear him talk about it, he grew up on the original series. It meant a lot to him growing up. I don't know that he was a big fan going forward, but the original series really meant a lot. Mm-hmm. And I know that he was in kind of talks about Star Trek for a while, not tied to Mudd, just as I'm interested. He was, you know, had feelers out. And I think it's really interesting that he's wound up as Harry Mudd and wanting to continue as Harry Mudd, because I think when you look at maybe what the original series was, I don't know that Harry Mudd represents maybe what a young Rainn Wilson was loving. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much more to the original series than a Harry Mudd story.
Okay, yeah.
But I like the sense that he's found an avenue to bring kind of his own energy and life and creativity to a character that I think was, you know, I think maybe one of the biggest problems with Harry Mudd for me in the original series is, aside from the moral questions we have now about the character, but he was never being written by comedy writers.
Yeah.
He was being written by,
like, Western writers and like, detective writers.
Like, you know, Gene Coon, Roddenberry, like, they were really great writers when they were on fire, but, like, they weren't comedy writers.
No.
And I think, you know, you see that if you have Mike McMahon writing Harry Mudd, suddenly it's like, oh, this is really working. Yeah. Like, he really knows how to use this character. And you've got Rainn Wilson.
It's Dwight Effron Schrute.
Yeah, who's directing him. And also probably at this point taking a certain amount of ownership over him in the writer's room and hopefully has some say as to how he's being written, which is something that did not happen in the past with any previous Star Trek series, really. So I think that's exciting that you can see of a really talented comedic actor coming in and kind of taking hold of a character and just seeing what he can do with them.
Can I reverse course quite dramatically
sure.
and then just ask you a question? Because you kind of brought it up a little bit earlier and it got me thinking, and we've brought it up on the series before, where we have a Q character who has that balance of menacing but also kind of light.
Yeah.
What do you think is the best episode from TNG or Voyager that really displays that quality from Q?
Where he's menacing?
Well, that kind of balance.
The
balance between the character. I've got one right in my brain, so it's a bit of an unfair question.
I feel like all good things.
Okay.
Yeah, like I feel like there is playfulness there, but he's really scary in certain parts of that.
My go-to episode's got to be Tapestry, though.
That's another great one. That was the one bouncing around my head as well, but I feel like he's maybe a little more playful. I feel like when you have that All Good Things, and even Encounter at Farpoint, which is not a great episode, but like he's definitely
Where'd those apples come from?
He's definitely walking that line of incredibly dangerous and charming very well.
Yeah, I think you just really like his World War III suit that he walks around in sucking narcotics out of.
You know that one day whether it's, you know, short treks or whether it's lower decks or something, someone is going to pay homage to that weird suit.
Yes.
It hasn't happened yet, but it's going to happen.
Okay. I cannot wait. Why don't we...
This could be like a flashback to that war.
I'd like to think that you were making an allusion to the Tuvok episode flashback. Let's talk about short treks as a whole.
Yeah.
I think you and I, we
it's been a long journey.
Well, it's been about 4 months, right?
Yeah.
And I think we came into this and we didn't quite know what to expect.
Did you expect anything good?
Yes, I did.
Did you? Okay.
Like, because I was looking at the pedigree of the people getting behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, wait, Michael Chabon, like, is penning one of these things?
Right.
I was like, okay. Rainn Wilson says he'll direct. Well, okay, he's directing himself. Mm-hmm. I get it. So I did think this was going to be the kind of webisodes that we got in the 1990s where Homicide: Life on the Street had a series.
Oh, I didn't even know about this.
They were horrible webisodes about like the other homicide unit investigating things over webcams.
Oh my God.
It looked like the kind of garbage you'd expect from like a web series.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't think we were going to be getting that. I really think that they wanted to take this seriously. I honestly was kind of legit surprised that they were actually, it seemed as if they were giving them kind of the same budget that they would give a typical episode. I mean, like 25%,
right,
of course, but they were not cheaping out on this.
No, how many sets are in this Harry Mudd one?
Oh, I know. Like,
there's
what,
quite
like
a few.
14, maybe? Well, not 14, but yeah.
Maybe like 8?
Yeah. 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 Okay. Well, briefly, let's count it. DeMilo transporter room, which of course we know is like a redress. We also see the corridor, which is a redress. We see that storage room is a redress. We're up to 3. We have the Tellarite transport ship. That's 4. We have
the Orion prison cell.
The Orion prison cell. We have the Klingon prison cell. We have the diminutive bounty hunter's walkway. So
you've got Harry Mudd's bridge.
So that's 8.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's an impressive thing.
There might be another one in there we're forgetting, but yeah, that's quite a few sets for a 15-minute streaming short episode.
Like, they are not like skimping out on
these
things at all. So I was very impressed by the writing quality for the most part on these. I would say, okay, let's just get out of the way. I think 3 out of 4 of these short treks were knockout wins for this franchise. I think the one that you and I are a little uneasy about is maybe Runaway.
Yeah.
I just don't think it was an interesting enough story to justify giving it a short trek. It seemed more of an after-school special and a lot of cliches about Star Trek.
Yeah.
This is, okay, The Escape Artist is the polar opposite of Runaway, where Runaway is falling into a lot of these lame Star Trek tropes, whereas
Escape Artist, like Runaway, also was what we were saying earlier, where it's kind of just like reused sets.
Yeah,
I'm like, okay, like this is what we're getting. It, you know, there was no real visual imagination to Runaway.
Well, no, I'll say the opening shot of the ship and how it pulls into the shuttle bay.
Sure,
I think that was actually visually
pretty good. But it wasn't going out there, because you look at Calypso, which was also, you know, set on like the Discovery ship. But you look at what it was doing visually with all the Fred Astaire dancing stuff and all that. Like, it was incredible.
Not just visually, but like sonically.
Yeah.
Like, I think you and I were incredibly impressed by the soundscape, the sound design that they were doing in this episode.
But there's not a lot like that in Runaway.
No.
Like, it does feel very much like, you know, kind of like those Marvel one-shots, which I've often referenced as what I expected out of these short treks.
Yeah.
And, you know, you said about the good writers, but there was like a Marvel one-shot written by Drew Pearce, who wrote Iron Man 3. And I remember watching it and being like, yeah, it was fine.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I expected from these short treks. And believe me, after Runaway, I'm like, here we go.
I was honestly surprised. Okay, like, I think there's some...
We were really nice to Runaway, by the way.
We were very nice to Runaway.
Yeah, when we reviewed that one.
Maybe a little too nice.
I think we were a little too
nice. I think we wanted to be diplomatic.
I think it was part of it was I didn't know if we were going downhill in the weeks to come.
Well, okay, so I think you and I talked off air, and I think we had this discussion, and I was like, you know what? I think they're probably going to, like, front load the weakest one, because we knew that the next one was going to focus on a character we had never met before, which, of course, was Kraft.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one would focus on a very popular character like Saru.
Yeah.
That was somebody we were very familiar with. I honestly thought that if there's going to be a weak one of the bunch, I thought that the Saru one was going to be the weakest. Yeah. You and I both really like the Saru one.
Yeah.
It's everything that a prequel should do, because we watch so many of these prequels. And look, I'm going to point to Solo.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those prequels where it's answering all the questions we never asked.
How did he get his belt?
How did he get the dice on the Millennium Falcon?
The dice are in one shot of the original Star Wars, and not even that noticeable.
Or how did he get his last name? Like, it's that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
The Saru one, it's like, oh, these are all questions that I, like, now have even more questions about Saru. I'm even more interested about this character's journey. You know, so I think The Brightest Star was like a knockout as well. And then I was like, okay, so we've had like two in a row that were pretty good. And you know me. You know my feelings about Harry Mudd.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah. Okay, I'm eating crow officially. I am on the Harry Mudd train right now as of today.
So that's why you're wearing a shirt that says Mudd's Whoa Man.
Okay, we need to print those off and get them ready for Vegas, you know, for our next Star Trek convention.
Yeah.
So, look, I went into this one thinking, like, I'm sure it'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think this might be my favorite short trek so far, in that I think it's doing everything that maybe Discovery should have been doing from the get-go. And mm-hmm. I think, like, it had a very tumultuous season one.
Yeah.
I think, like, from the sounds of it, behind the scenes, season two has been kind of tumultuous as well.
We'll see if that really comes across in the scripts, but yeah. Yeah.
So I think maybe the short treks are actually a bit of a litmus test for how they're kind of figuring their S out going, you know, forward, you know, mm-hmm. maybe midway through season two. I think season two is going to be better than season one of Star Trek Discovery, just based on what we've seen so far.
I have a feeling that'll be the case. And I think a lot of that has to do with something that the first season didn't have the advantage of, which is a gelled cast. You know, when you see these clips in the trailers of the various Star Trek Discovery members bouncing off each other, there's a camaraderie there that just didn't exist at the start of the first season. And that really isn't the case in the first season of any show.
No.
So, you know, it just has that advantage going into season two of, we want to see these people, you know, bouncing off one another and hanging out.
Despite the fact that I think you and I both say that the strongest feature of Star Trek Discovery is the cast, though, mm-hmm. and the characters, and we all like every single character that is introduced, notwithstanding the revelation of Lorca being a sexual predator.
Right.
But that aside, so I think going forward, I think they've got a better handle on everything going with their cast. I think maybe they kind of know what works story-wise, maybe what doesn't work story-wise, and I hope that maybe these short treks kind of portend to what will be going forward with Star Trek Discovery Season 2.
You know, they've hinted that short treks are going to be going onwards, like they will be landing. It seemed like they were implying, there was an interview with, was it the head of CBS or something like that, where he's...
We can't say his name.
Yeah, I can't remember who it was that actually said it, but who basically implied that there would be short treks landing probably between season two of Discovery and Picard. And
I'm down.
Yeah, yeah. So does this seem like a viable thing going forward? Like, did these four open the door for like huge potential going forward of what we can do with short treks?
Short answer, yes.
Yeah.
Longer answer is the only thing that has me concerned is that I think the reason why people are drawn to Star Trek is because these smaller character moments, and I think that the short treks lend themselves to more of these kind of smaller stories.
Mm-hmm.
So my only concern is maybe Discovery needs to go big. It can't do like a small one-off character-centric story. It has to have some big kind of explosive revelation going on
right.
nonstop.
Well, it is like a bullet.
As Alex Kurtzman said in an interview, yes. So I would say, look, the first batch of short treks, I think, proved to be overall quite successful. And I think that they can prove that further batches of short treks will at least grab our attention. We'll at least be curious mm-hmm. week in, week out about what's going to come next. Because I love the fact, and I think this is what makes Star Trek so great. You watch Voyager, DS9, TNG, TOS, Enterprise, week in, week out. You don't know if it's going to be a caper episode. You don't know if it's going to be like a melodrama. You don't know if it's going to be a thriller, hard sci-fi.
Yeah.
And I think we got kind of that sort of feeling once again with these short treks.
Yeah, they really did have the genre hopping that is my favorite thing about the original series.
Whereas I think Discovery, it felt a little bit more monolithic week to week.
Yeah, you did have episodes like Magic to make the Saints Man. Yeah. That's really the standout of kind of jumping into a different genre. But outside of that, not so much.
Doesn't it kind of feel weird to you and me that you and I seem to be the biggest proponents of Magic?
I know.
And it seems amongst fans, it seems to be like, I want to say well regarded, but like kind of middling episode.
Right, right.
It just surprises me so much because I think it embodies Star Trek so much more than all the other episodes that we've consumed through Discovery Season 1, even though I think there's some great episodes, some great standout episodes that we got in Season 1.
I think there is a little bit of an appetite, though, nowadays for, you know, I talk to people at work, for example, who watch a lot of TV, and, you know, the shows that really tend to appeal to them are shows like The Walking Dead or Game of Thrones or, you know, shows that have kind of shocking moments and big, big shifts in where the show is going. Breaking Bad, another good example, you know, where you're kind of building to these big, you know, reveals or twists or changes in direction. And I think that that's something Discovery is very much delivering, I think, for them. And, you know, I think that's something that some of the people I know who are just general TV viewers who are watching Discovery are really enjoying about the show is that they don't know where it's going. It's going to shift on them. You know, they're kind of along for the ride.
I still contend that the best, like, scene in Star Trek Discovery Season 1 was in The Wolf Inside, where we have that confrontation between Burnham and Tyler when he realizes, wait a minute, I'm a Klingon infiltrator, and he attacks her. And, like
that episode, I don't remember how highly I ranked it when we did our rankings of the individual episodes of Discovery, but like that was one on the rewatch that jumped. I felt like it jumped higher for me. Like, I really loved that episode on the rewatch.
Yeah, I'm totally with you there as well. There are a lot of great moments in The Wolf Inside as well. So, overall, do we want to do like a gold, silver, bronze, and participation medal for the
for Runaway? Yes.
Okay. I'll go to you first. Why don't you start with your participation medal and then go to your bronze, silver, gold, etc.
Okay, so my participation is obviously Runaway. I just don't think there's any other competition. Well,
you had
for that.
To throw out the obviously.
Well, it is really obvious. I think it's pretty clear to people that watch these. If you look at the IMDb scores, I believe that's the lowest scoring one. I think it's pretty clear why. Yeah. And you know what? Tilly's a character that's really lovable, really fun.
She's a fan favorite.
She is a fan favorite. I wish they'd found a story to kind of tie her to that was, you know, you look at the other ones and what they did for their characters. What that one did for Tilly was pretty minor stuff.
It almost, I don't know, felt like they're
sitcom-y.
Sitcom-y, and they're pulling her backwards.
Right.
I don't think this did her character any favors, whereas I look at the other episodes.
It felt like they were kind of like blowing the doors open on these characters into new avenues that we'd never seen before.
And this didn't.
I mean, other than her arguing with her mother, which is really, again, sitcom-y stuff.
And we also already had hints of that, so this didn't. Yeah. This was not revelatory at all.
Yeah.
Okay, Cam, bronze medal.
This is tough because I feel like the other three are actually quite strong in what they do with their characters. Yeah. Like, to me, there's a pretty big gulf in quality between these three and Runaway.
That's why Runaway is just getting the participation medal.
So I'm going to give the bronze, I think, to The Brightest Star, an episode I really enjoy.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, like, leap off the screen, I think, the way the other two do.
The way that a Kelpian can leap from his feet.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, it's a really great Saru origin story. I loved it. I will happily watch it again, but I think it's the least inventive of the three at the top.
Like it's not as subversive within the Star Trek, you know, genre.
But even just visually or sonically, like it's not doing things that feel like pushing the medium or trying to really play with the form.
And I'm totally with you so far with the rankings. I'll jump in once my rankings differ from yours.
Sure.
But I'll say this with regards to the visuals in this. You and I both love the depiction of the Kelpian planet. What was it called? I remember you knew the name and I wasn't quite sure.
It was on my notes at the time.
I know.
It's gone.
Sorry to put you on the spot, but it wasn't called like Kelpia.
Isn't it like, now I'm just going to throw a name out that's totally wrong, but wasn't it like Calavar or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
Canavar or something. Yeah, yeah. It was something along those lines, but yes.
I totally agree with you with your ranking of Brightest Star. And I do agree. I think there's a big gulf between Runaway and Brightest Star. Mm-hmm. And I think you and I were both like genuinely like surprised and delighted by what we got from Saru on mm-hmm. the Brightest Star. And I was like, oh, this like is a very interesting kind of origin story. I think there's still a lot of question marks going forward about Saru and I guess like the dismissal, the prime directive.
Right.
In all this. And yeah. I would love to see Saru at Starfleet Academy for a future short trek. That is the short trek that I want to see next.
That's a question I want to get to after, is what other characters we think will get short treks coming up.
But your silver medal.
Yes, my second place, silver medal. I think I'm going to give it to Calypso.
Okay.
An episode I really thought was fantastic. You can listen to that review. We're like leaping through hoops over it.
I think it blew us away at the time.
Yeah.
It did not focus on any of our main characters aside from the very familiar set of mm-hmm. Discovery. And so how invested can we get in this character that we only know for 14 and a half minutes.
Right.
Well, the answer is quite invested.
Yeah. And what I loved was, I mean, I'm an old movie buff just in general. And so seeing, tributes to like Funny Face is so weird that I loved it. Yeah. And just what it did with showcasing their dance sequences and also bringing in some really geeky, high concept sci-fi ideas. It was a very, very smart episode. And it was written by Michael Chabon, right? And, it just felt like someone who loves sci-fi and was like, how geeky can I make this 15 minutes while also having a very emotional story? And Michael Chabon was also, I've said in the past, but he was one of the co-writers on Spider-Man 2, which I think is one of the best superhero movies of all time, and has that mix of just amazing fan-pleasing moments with genuine emotion. And I think Calypso delivered that. And so you say, why did I put that in my second place? I think it's because Kraft as a character lacks one thing that the escape artist brings, which is an explosion of charisma in your lead performer. I think the escape artist, with Rainn Wilson, is just, I mean, the guy, did what, 7 seasons of The Office? Was it 7?
9.
Oh my God. Yeah, 9 seasons of The Office. He is just an absolute pro at, this sorts of playful, comedic dialogue. Yeah. His timing is amazing.
Oh, exactly.
He's playing with language in fun ways. And so your eyes are just transfixed to him. But all around him is this story that's just as innovative and exciting and fun as what Calypso did. So it really is just that burst of star power, no pun intended, with Rainn Wilson that, to me, propels the escape artist just a slot above Calypso. It's close.
I genuinely did not think going into this that any of these short treks would eclipse Calypso. Because mm-hmm. for all the reasons that you outlined there, I was so blown away by Calypso. It was the kind of Star Trek story that I wanted Discovery to be telling throughout season 1.
I could see Calypso being an episode of Star Trek Discovery. Not necessarily with Kraft, but I could see us getting that type of story down the road, which is exciting.
Very much so. So you and I, we have all the same rankings here. Like mm-hmm. for me, Escape Artist takes the gold medal, Calypso the silver. And the very fact of the matter is, I think the all-star here is maybe Mike McMahon. And mm-hmm. That's not to take anything away from Rainn Wilson, because I think you outlined exactly why this guy... I think he could headline a good Star Trek sitcom sort of spinoff.
Right.
That would not... Cam, I just think it's bizarre that if you talk to Tyler from 2017, he was livid at the very idea, and now I've been swooning over Rainn Wilson ever since. Maybe in the blog, could you include the photo of you and me with Rainn Wilson at the Star Trek convention, perhaps?
I can maybe do that, yeah.
Not necessarily our podcast artwork, but blah, blah, blah.
That's why you're wearing a hat right now. It says, I, Mud Fan.
I've owned that hat for about 18 years. Yeah. It has nothing to do with this episode. Pure coincidence, Cameron. But no, I think the story is doing exact, and I think we knew we were in for something special within 2 seconds when the main credits came on and they cut the very uplifting sort of orchestral music,
right.
Went to full on disco sort of music.
Yeah. And it was just this rapid fire dialogue right off the bat, just throwing funny line after funny line.
I mean, the regicide stuff, the attempts to go with the you know, cudgel, like,
penetrating the space
penetrating
whale.
Penetrating the space whale. You know, I like, you and I were like giggling for like a solid, like, 90 seconds, like within like the very beginning of this one. So
if you can start and finish strong, you've got something really good when it's a 15 minute story.
Okay. So my biggest worry about this is, you know, how was the escape artist really going to wrap everything up? You know, because we know that, like, okay, Harry Mudd, he's obviously going to escape. And then I'm like, oh, androids. Yeah. As soon as I saw that this is an android episode, like, I just totally lit up. I was just beaming with joy. Like, this is so clearly from a writer who loves Star Trek and wants to play with what we know about the universe, what works, what doesn't work. And the fact that this guy is going to be in charge of the new animated series, I am even more excited about the animated series than I was before, and that's saying a lot.
Yeah, me too. And it definitely opens the door for what we can see from Harry Mudd in the future.
Yeah.
And like the types of adventures he could have. And I'm very excited about that. I never would have said this off the bat, but he's a character who feels like he has possibilities now.
Yeah.
That I never would have expected when Rainn Wilson was announced. Like, honestly, when they announced him as Harry Mudd, I was like, well, that sounds like a one episode kind of thing. I didn't really expect it to be a particularly, like, memorable episode. Because why would it be? Like, to me, the Harry Mudd episodes of the original series aren't that memorable, other than his character very much stands out. You know, the stories never really did to me, though.
I just thought that, look, if you're going to go with that kind of, you know, rogue sort of character, why not go with a Cyrano Jones? Mm-hmm. Yeah, why not just call him Cyrano Jones? I'm totally happy with the fact that we've got this Harry Mudd story. Cam, you were the one that posed this question. Like,
yeah.
What other characters could sustain a short trek?
Yeah, say we get four more between Discovery Season 2 and Picard. What characters do you think are going to get them?
Three words, Cameron. Mm-hmm. Admiral Brett Anderson.
It's his final moments at the Battle of the Binary Stars.
Yeah, no, that would work because he went all self-destruct on us.
Yeah.
You know, that. I kid only because he was the one Star Trek actor who's ever replied to subspace transmissions on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, Terry Serpico, if you're out there, we love you as Brett Anderson.
Yeah,
we'd love to see more of you. But for me, okay, so somebody that I would think could sustain like a 15-minute short trek, and it would be interesting. I think there's more to dive into. Let's do a Hugh and Paul sort of short trek. And I know that maybe the comic book that they did was maybe not the most engaging.
Yeah.
I think there are definitely other stories that we could tell between those two characters. And I think maybe there's the opportunity for maybe the series to right some wrongs with regards to how Paul Stamets dealt with the death of his partner.
Death question mark.
I know, but it's kind of the shrug of shoulders and the brief confrontation that he had with Ash Tyler. I felt very unsatisfied with how everything was handled there.
Yeah,
me too. And I think that maybe a short trek with those two characters and maybe kind of an aftermath sort of episode with Paul, I think that would actually do justice to the memory of Hugh Colbert there. Mm. What about you, Cam?
My prediction, you know that sneezing alien you referenced earlier?
Oh, yeah.
I think he will be getting a short trek.
Just sneezing all over everyone.
I have gotten the sense that character is going to be someone who's around a bit.
Okay.
And so, like, that seems like a prime character to throw off into his own adventure, because maybe there's just not enough time for him in the serialized nature of Star Trek Season 2.
Yeah.
Where you've got all this Spock stuff going on. But I could also see one of the characters from the Enterprise having their own short trek as well, whether it's Pike or Number One or something.
I mean, Dr. Boyce.
Dr. Boyce would be amazing.
Yeah.
But you got to save that one to last because none of the others will compete.
I don't know. I'll just throw this out there. What about a Talosian short trek?
I mean, I am 100% down.
We just see them collecting people for the menagerie. Like, you know, that would be fun.
I mean, I think Vina would be crash landing around this time, sure. Wouldn't she?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because this is how many years before the cage?
Okay, so that's a good question. Okay, so this is 10 years before
Kirk, they say.
Kirk.
Yeah.
And what's the time difference between Kirk and the cage?
I can't remember.
I think it's 3 to 5 years.
3 to 5?
Yeah, so I think...
So Vina's, I think, already there.
So she's about 4 years difference. From 4 years from now, it'll be the cage, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think, yeah, you could buy that Vina is there on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so you and I are both predicting we're getting a Vina short trek. Yeah.
Well, okay. I have often said I would love to see Talosians back on Star Trek at some point because they're so iconic.
But the thing
that's the best way to do it because I don't think they're going to ever put them in a normal serialized Star Trek story.
Look, you're never allowed to journey to Talos.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, maybe a short trek is kind of the best way to address this issue. Okay, so Cam, we've got 3 out of 4. Mm-hmm. I'll throw it back to you.
Okay, I mean, we saw in this round you had 2 Discovery cast members and that you had Tilly and you had Saru. So other than Brett Anderson, it's not going to be Burnham.
No.
It's, you know, I have a hard time believing we're not going to see something with maybe Ash, Tyler, and Laurel.
Yeah.
That might be the case, even if it's just Laurel, actually, a 15-minute short trek on Laurel.
So I think that Laurel has more interesting possibilities,
yeah.
Other than if we learn, you know, about the original Ash Tyler.
Sure.
I think that could be
really cool.
You know,
but I feel like you had to do that this season.
I think so. So I'm down for a Laurel short trek. Her, I don't know, dealing with some sort. You know, it's not going to be like a palace intrigue sort of episode. I think it's going to be a smaller story.
Right.
But I say that you look at an episode like, you know, Calypso, and that seems almost kind of like a bigger, you know, grander story. Same with Escape Artists. So I don't know. Yeah. Like, I think I love the fact that the short treks, this is what Star Trek does best. They can be anything, anytime. And
yeah.
I'm down for a palace intrigue, Game of Thrones-esque Laurel episode.
Or a musical episode.
Why not? You know, I think Ira Stephen Bear has maybe hinted that, like, maybe he wanted to do a musical episode at one point.
Yeah.
And I think Joss Whedon he ended up doing that in Buffy season 6.
Yep.
And he said it was literally like the toughest thing he's ever done, where it's like you have to write all the music, which is incredibly difficult.
Yep.
You know, it is an extendo episode, which is incredibly difficult to do on the networks at the time. So if we can get it, but look, CBS All Access, yeah, why not have a musical Star Trek episode?
I mean, so many famous directors, like Spielberg, for example, have talked about, John Woo used to talk about how, like, all they wanted to do was a musical. And they ended up doing action because that's generally what, you know, an action movie is basically a musical nowadays. They're, you know, the choreography and what makes them stand out is that level of high expertise. But, you know, Spielberg's finally doing, you know, West Side Story. Like, you can see a lot of very talented Hollywood people want to do musicals. And a short trek is actually a really good excuse to do it because it's only 15 minutes. You don't need to fill out 2 hours worth of music. So I would love to see that. I think that'd be a fun idea for a 15-minute lark of a short trek.
Did you say Lorca?
That's the musical episode.
Okay.
That's how we're introduced to Prime Lorca.
Okay. Cam, do we want to do a little bit of wrapping up for this one?
Yes, for sure. We just wanted to give a thanks to one of our listeners, Mason Wong, who wrote up his list of the top 8 podcasts of 2018 and was kind enough to include us.
I was, you know, very flattered that we've got somebody who's so dedicated to the show that he'd include us in some of the podcasts. Cam, would you read this comment, this little mini review that Mason Wong did for our show?
Yes, he said, "This is my favorite Trek podcast that is still in production," and then in brackets, "Engage, the official Star Trek podcast with Jordan Hoffman. My all-time favorite Star Trek podcast was unfortunately canceled," end of bracket. "The co-hosts are dedicated fans of all incarnations of Trek. They were a bit more critical of Star Trek Discovery than I would prefer, but their views are always fair and thoughtful."
Mason, were we too critical of the Escape Artist? I think not.
I will say, though, like, I hope there are people that do disagree with us, because I think the conversation is super boring if people are tuning in every week to hear us say exactly what they're thinking.
Or even if you and I agree all the time.
Yeah.
It's just funny because you and I don't often agree, and we're all kind of aligned with our rankings of these short treks here.
Yeah.
I'll give a shout out to Jordan Hoffman. You and I see him every year at the Star Trek convention. We converse with him. He's standing on stage. We're lowly little peasants at the microphones, but it's still it's a bummer to me that the Engage podcast still isn't running, and I'm glad that we're able to fill that void for at least some fans there.
Yeah, so you can check out Mason's full list at masonwong.com. Again, it's a really fun list, and there's some good recommendations there for other podcasts and other topics other than Star Trek. Okay, so on that note, I believe our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, What are we doing next week?
Cam, we're coming up to the Star Trek Discovery season premiere, but we're not quite
there. We are.
There.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I know. I know. Cam, I'm looking at my schedule.
Yeah.
I'm like, how are we going to do this podcast, plus my work and plus all the other like extracurricular activities I have? Anyway, Cam, we will be covering right ahead of this Discovery premiere. What makes for a good or bad season premiere when it comes to Star Trek? So we are going to be looking through every single series, every single franchise. We're not, I think we can skip the series premiere. That has a totally different sort of MO versus sure. all the other season premieres. But I think with the season premieres, there's so much to delve into about like how it's kind of maybe table setting to a certain degree, setting a certain tone, wrapping things up from maybe some cliffhangers, and really maybe what our expectations are moving forward into mm-hmm. Star Trek season two. We kind of touched upon this in this episode, but I think there's maybe more we can delve into, and I think this is going to be a really fun one, just gearing up for the return of Star Trek week to week for I think what 14 episodes now.
Yep, 14 yeah. according to Anson Mount. Yes,
correct.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Venus de Milo Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P. P as in penetrating space whales. O-R T-O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.